All right, Pittsburgh section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History. This is Harold Kimball and Ann Fagan interviewing Dr. Reuben Schlesinger, Monday, August 4th, 1986, in his office in Pitt University's Fort Quadrangle on the Pitt campus in Oakland, Pittsburgh, PA. Dr. Schlesinger, last time we talked quite a bit about the Jewish community in Pittsburgh, and I wonder if you can make any further comments about it. About the changes, if you've seen any explicit or anything you'd like to say further about the Jewish community in Pittsburgh.
Well, I think it's a much more integrated community than it was. You don't have the former breakdown of the very aristocratic German Jews, and then the middle-class Jews who were basically European, Russian, Polish, Hungarian, and then a mixture of others. That seems to have disappeared because there seems to be a general common thread linked around Israel to some extent, support of Israel, Israel bonds. And the other one is a greater return to tradition among the highly reformed and a movement towards the center among the former Orthodox. You do have a small segment of Orthodox and then also particular Hasidic groups, aside from those who have their own traditions and own basic structure. You have much more integration. Mm-hmm. For example, you will have through the Federation a higher representation than you did formerly of different groups.
With the Tree of Life, and I wonder if you could tell us a little more about your activities there. Are you pretty involved at the Tree of Life?
Yes, my wife and I both are. I've been president. I've been chairman of a number of committees, particularly the Ritual Committee. I've been on a number of other committees in the past year, such as personnel, endowment, long-range planning. She's been president of the Sisterhood, has been chairman of a number of their dances, a number of their affairs. She's on their board of directors. I'm a lifetime member of the board of directors because I've been a past president. I attend their meetings regularly, so we're quite involved.
Mm-hmm. It is a beautiful building, and I've often wondered how many, what's the size of the membership?
It's approximately 1,000 members now.
Really? And would you say they are, or I'd rather ask you to comment on what economic level most of them?
Most of them would be upper middle class. You don't mm-hmm. have a high representation of the quote wealth of Pittsburgh there. You have a few, but not, and you have a tremendous number of professional people. You could probably run a meeting of the County Bar Association mm-hmm. or of the medical practice, even on our board. There probably are half a dozen doctors, a half a dozen lawyers, mm-hmm. other professional people, a number of PhD degrees, very strongly professional oriented.
Do they participate in the services? Do the from the membership come up and act as a rabbi?
Or no, we have
would you
our
tell
own,
us how it works?
We have our own rabbi.
I see.
And we have our own cantor, and we have a professional choir.
I see.
Now, during the course of the week, in the daily morning services, members conduct the service. Mm-hmm. In the evening, there's a daily Minhag and Maariv service, members conduct that service. Mm-hmm. But as far as at holidays, Saturdays, there's a rabbi that conducts it. Or if by chance both the rabbi and the cantor are absent, the executive director will conduct it. But it strongly believes in the presence of a rabbi, which is not true with a couple of other congregations in Pittsburgh.
I was comparing it, or rather I'd like to hear you compare it to, let's say, the Hebrew Institute, which
well,
is
Hebrew close Institute by. Is not a synagogue. They don't run services.
Oh, I thought they did.
No. Different groups meet at the Hebrew Institute.
Conduct the services.
Yeah, so they're not Hebrew Institute services, for example. Young People's meets at the Hebrew Institute.
Yes.
that's not the Hebrew Institute. They just take space.
I see.
There is no such, they may have it for children in their classes, but there is no adult Hebrew Institute service.
You had mentioned a bit last week, and maybe we ought to continue this a little, some of the problems you saw, some of the lacks within the community. You had talked, for example, about the lack of hospitality extended to strangers. You might want to comment on other lacks as you see them.
Well, I think you have not only that hospitality proposition, but a certain amount of lack of coordination. At one time, there was a synagogue, a conservative synagogue coordinating committee. When I was president of Tree of Life, I helped get that organized. And it had the conservative congregations, particularly in the Squirrel Hill East End area, so that they wouldn't go out competing against each other. The basic problem is to get the non-affiliated member in Pittsburgh to affiliate. And I don't know the figure now, but at one time, only about 40% of the Jews in Pittsburgh were affiliated with any synagogue. I'm trying to get the other ones. You don't get them to join a synagogue by saying, mine is better than yours, yours is deficient in this manner. Mm-hmm. And there's certain other types of problems that can be worked out on a cooperative basis. Well, that's disintegrated. And I don't know whether it's disintegrated because of personalities or disintegrated because of lack of interest, but that, I think, could do a lot. There's a conflict. The Orthodox rabbis will not come into a conservative synagogue for any purpose. For example, when a prior rabbi died, the Orthodox rabbis did not come to his funeral, with the exception of one.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Now to switch to another political observations. Would you like to discuss the Reagan administration, the present Reagan administration, with the huge debt our country has accumulated? And what do you think the future holds for our children?
Well, huge debt is more newspaper publicity than meaningfulness.
Oh, really?
It doesn't really mean anything, because what does it mean? Newspapers will make out that it's $2 trillion. Well, it may be $2 trillion, but it doesn't mean anything. It's not doing anything. It could become a problem in the accumulation each year as it generates some needs for capital. Actually, this is something that I lecture on for several hours before different public groups, because one of the first questions they ask is about the debt. That doesn't mean a thing. If the government suddenly went to you and you have a bond, and they said, look, you're going to pay off the bond. You feel, oh, good, I'm going to get paid off my bond. So they could print money to pay it off, in which case your money wouldn't be worth anything. Or, on the other hand, they can borrow other money to pay off your bond and just create more debt. But the process of debt creation is serious when it is created, not after you have it. Because when it's created, that means the government has spent money that you could have spent yourself. Now you don't have that money. The other point is that if the government suddenly today decided to cut its budget $200 billion and have a debt, look at all the bleeding hearts that would start crying. It's not written in stone that a student, because you want to go to college, can't afford, the government has to give you money. That never existed in the United States until the Johnson days. Now all the students figure, well, we've got to get government loans.
Yeah.
That costs money. Food stamps, subsidized housing, all these programs are entitlements, which people never had to begin with. They gave it to them, and now they want them.
Well, now that they're going to eliminate some of the new, well, not really, are they? The new tax reform that's coming up?
Well, what they should do in that is cut off all shelters. There's no reason why you should have a limited partnership. Take downtown a lot of these buildings and things,
yes.
Limited partnerships. Who loses the money in it? The lender, not the person putting up the building.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that should force that individual to go into bankruptcy. If you take a chance, you do well, all right, you should make money, but you should not go into a venture and then, because of tax gimmicks, get a write-off and then go into a receivership,
mm-hmm.
or proposition somebody with a settlement.
Is that going to be changed?
It should be. It may get changed. Some of the shelters will get changed.
Yes. Let's see if there's anything else. Oh, yeah. What about the future?
It's a different kind of future than we have before. For example, the Pittsburgh area will be a different kind of area. And a lot of people who are displaced in the transition will be hurt. The steel mill workers will be hurt seriously. And there won't be another steel industry in Pittsburgh. Once it's gone, it's not going to come back.
Well, now we're experiencing a strike at U.S. Steel.
That's stupid.
Yes. What do they hope to gain by this strike? The workers, I mean.
Well, they don't want to have their wages cut. Once you're accustomed to making $30,000 a year, you don't want to have it cut to $20,000.
Yeah. It's a hard thing for them to accept, but don't you think years ago it was accepted?
No.
Wasn't it ever in the early 1920s?
No.
You got a cut in wages. I was out there as a wage earner, and it was nothing for the employer to say, well, things are bad, we're going to all take a 5% cut or a 10% cut.
Yeah, but that was in a different proposition. That was a cut because you saw a depression.
Yes.
And you figured when depression's over, you're going to come back again. But here's a cut where you don't see a recovery to get back your earnings. For example, the 1959 strike in steel industry lasted over 100 days. But then the steel workers and everybody figured, well, it's going to be over one day and we're going to be a booming industry afterwards. Now it's a different proposition because now they see, well, when it's over, what do you got? You still have an inefficient operation and next year get cut again. So it's a different approach to what the future is like.
Mm-hmm. So do you think they'll settle this strike in favor of the employees or just let them
run? It'll be some kind of compromise.
A compromise. Doesn't look too good.
The big issues are not money, they're internal work rules.
I see.
See, if you get 55-60% productivity out of a worker, you're doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Now if you can raise that to 80%, that's better than a wage cut.
Is there something you'd like to ask Anne while
I think it's a good idea, if you will, Dr. Schlesinger, to talk a bit more about what you see for Pittsburgh, you as an economist with a special interest in this city.
I see Pittsburgh spinning its wheels an awful lot. Everybody talks about high tech. They have to remember that there are other areas that speak of high tech also. They have other attractions. Just for example, a minor thing like you're going to close theaters downtown because of a 10% amusement tax, or another minor thing. People come downtown to watch a regatta. So that particular day, they can let them park illegally. No, they have to tag and tow a dozen people. That makes people angry. You don't gain anything out of it. Once a car is parked there, whether it's obstructing traffic or not, traffic is obstructed. So you do things to encourage people to come, not to discourage them. And even though they're minor things, that creates a very, very bad public image. The whole structure of the city is not conducive for new industry to come here. They've got to change the whole way of thinking about what industry wants. Whenever you take an outfit like General Motors, they looked at the Saturn plant. They turned Pittsburgh down very quickly. Because what do you have to offer them that someplace else could not? As a matter of fact, they may not even open up the Saturn plant anyways. That may not even take place. They may be opened up at one of their existing plants.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from that, Pittsburgh didn't show up well when they reviewed the situation. The traffic patterns are bad. The roadways are bad. The social life, the entertainment life is not good. The downtown doesn't do much to attract people because if you want to drive downtown, you see a lot of empty streets, they don't let you park. What great harm would it be if they allowed automobiles to park on Fifth Avenue in the evening? It's not obstructing traffic.
Yeah. So who's at fault? Would you say the council?
It's a whole, it's not a particular group, it's a total syndrome.
I see.
It's been a situation where you've never faced a problem before, or you never faced up to it, and now you suddenly have problems, becomes difficult to solve them because it's a new situation.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always a little bit too late. Take like a convention center. It's the wrong location. Three River Stadium is the wrong location. Because you build a stadium, people can't get there.
Yeah, the convention center has been a failure, right?
So far, they're trying to make it into more of a success, but if you ever held a meeting in there, you're in a very dreary room. It's not attractive.
That's it.
Do you want to comment on some of the local politicians you've known during your career as an economist, and who seemed to you to be the most effective for Pittsburgh?
Well, I thought the group around Lawrence, Barr, that was a very effective group. Current administration, a very serious administration. But it's being faced with problems, so many problems at one time, that I think it's in a mass of problems and doesn't really have an integrated plan as to how to get out of it. It's almost an ad hoc day-to-day proposition. We have a crisis and we manage by crisis. One thing, though, it's a relatively safe place to walk around downtown. I give lectures downtown, and I'll walk from where I am to a parking lot a couple blocks, and I'm not worried. Can't do that in Cleveland or in some of the other cities.
Well, would you like to make a comment about our mayor?
I think he's doing an adequate job in the scope in which he has to operate, because he's got all these problems that keep cropping up. It's called the infrastructure of Pittsburgh was allowed to go to pot in a hurry, and he's trying to correct it. He tried to correct too many things at one time, and so you have to be torn in all kinds of directions. Very serious, very hardworking. But he can't stem the tide of economic change. I mean, he can't keep Gulf from leaving Pittsburgh. He can't keep Kaufman's and Horns from merging.
True. I have another question here, which is opposite of what we're talking about. How do you feel now, at 70 years of age, about your health and continuing in your work? That's pretty personal. You don't have to answer it.
Well, I don't believe in a retirement per se. You have to quit doing certain things because of rules of your organization. For example, I'm emeritus here at the university, which means that I'm out of their tenure stream, do not have a full teaching load, but I'll still be teaching on a part-time basis, but that's at the preference of the department. So I still do my consulting work and outside work, and I'm called into lecture elsewhere, but I don't believe in a sharp retirement as such.
That's
you
good.
You can only play golf so many times a week.
Very true.
Or play bridge or do volunteer work.
Would you like to comment on your students? How do you feel about the students today in your classes compared to, let's say, 10 years ago or so? Is there a difference?
Yes, the students today are a little bit more serious in terms of vocational potential. They're less theoretical inclined. I'll get, for example, 250, 300 students in a course in government and business, because a lot of the students are interested in knowing some of the rules and regulations of the government with reference to business practices. Some will go into law school, probably about 25% of them will. It's career oriented. I have 10 to 15 students who are on internships. These are ones who work with business firms around town in the hope that maybe that will develop into a job. 10 years ago, you might have one. As far as academic ability, there's no difference. There's no difference based upon their background. I don't care if they go to the finest prep schools or just to an average high school. They perform as well after the first semester in college.
That's interesting.
Because they may have a little advantage the first semester in knowing how to study. After that's over, it doesn't make any difference.
But you would say there's a greater surge, do you think, towards business that the average, at least I've found, student is business-oriented, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, more interested in, well, some kind
making
of
making money.
Yeah, that's vocational orientation, not necessarily that this may want to be a profession.
Right.
But it's something where he's going to make a livelihood, using the college education to help make a livelihood.
Yes. Now we have to talk some more about, did we talk about the Jewish community, how it appears to you now compared to years ago?
Yes.
We did that.
Yeah. How about changes in Pitt, directions you see a big urban university going in as you've looked at this school over your professional career?
Oh, they keep going around and around because things which are talked about now were talked about 20 years ago, discarded, come back in again, discarded, come back in again. For example, there's talk now about making the School of Education a professional school. I sat on a meeting on that 25 years ago. There's talk now about reopening up the undergraduate school of business. Well, you went 2 years to the college and you went to school of business. And it was changed 4 years school of business. And then it was changed no undergraduate school of business, strictly graduate. Now you have a business major. And now there's a proposal to go back again and have an undergraduate school of business. The curriculum changes, but the philosophy keeps going around. There's only a certain number of things you can do.
Do you see serious changes because of rising costs in university education?
Not particularly, because the rising costs merely mean that tuitions and costs basically will go up. Pitt tuition has not gone up that rapidly because state-related, but in the 1950s, I think it was $300 a year.
Compared to, what is it today?
Today, for a state student, it's probably about $2,000 or $2,100 a semester. That's $4,000 compared to the neighboring schools, which is $10,000.
And then, two, the cost of housing evidently has gone up pretty much.
Yeah. But I mean, when I say 10, that's the total cost package.
Yeah. Food and board.
Your cost to professors has gone up considerably. It's not unusual now for a top cost professor to get $100,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the 1920s, $10,000 was the top.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe we're going to see the day, let's say the year 2500, when a home will sell for $200,000-$300,000 will be the average price of a home?
It might be that, but then the minimum wage, instead of being $3.35 an hour, might be $7 an hour, or you might have a reevaluation, you knock off a couple of zeros from everything.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make any difference.
But you don't see the day when prices will reverse. That prices may go down, that you might get a home for $50,000.
Sure, a lot of them. I can name you a lot of areas right now in Pittsburgh where you lose money if you want to sell your house.
Really?
About the Churchill.
I didn't know that.
You can't sell them for Churchill. Or take certain portions of Squirrel Hill, not getting the price that you did.
Then property values are going down right
some,
now.
Some are and some are not. It depends on where the demand is. If by chance you get a new executive coming into Pittsburgh, the areas where he's going to go, O'Hara, Fox Chapel, Mount Lebanon, or St. Clair, those are going up. But the he's not going to go into Lower Oakland or certain portions of Squirrel Hill, East End, where the areas and the prices are not going up.
So there's a selection left.
Yeah, it's strictly a demand and supply proposition.
Mm-hmm.
The house that you might pay $100,000 in Pittsburgh right now, that same house near San Francisco, is $300,000.
Mm-hmm. What about the words from some economists that we're looking at a declining standard of living in our country? How do you feel about that as an economist?
Depends what you put into your standard of living. Because if you have a television set, but you don't have any food, is that a change in your standard of living? If you wanted to live like the people in 1929 lived, then you could save an awful lot of money, even if you're only making minimum wages. But people don't want to live that way. It means a radio instead of a television set. It means all hand washing, no automatic washer, dryer, or anything like that.
It's a good observation. No air conditioning.
No.
So we are leading a more fruitful life?
Well, I don't know where fruitful is, but you're living.
It's not the right
answer. More convenient life.
Yes.
And one where you have various gadgets perform services for you.
Yes.
But where people are complaining, they would like to enjoy the things that other people enjoy. Now, take for example, the baseball team complains about low attendance.
Yeah.
But the reason their attendance is low is that the average kind of family which supported the baseball team can't spend the money to go see a baseball game. I was just talking to one of the men that works in our building, and he was saying, like, he used to like to take his two children to a ball game, and it cost him $50 every time he went, because when he went to a ball game, he didn't want to sit in the bleacher, so he wanted a good seat. He went to the ball game. His kids were always bothering to buy him this souvenir or that souvenir, a hat, a helmet, this or that, and the food out there. And by the time he was through, it ran up into money. So, well, he didn't object to that so much because he had another job. Now he lost his other job. He didn't go on a baseball game this year. And when steel mill workers on strike, you're not going to go to a baseball game because he could watch it on television anyways.
True. How come these people who run the baseball games, or the people in charge, are not aware of that?
They are aware of it.
And
there's nothing with that. But you see what the Pirates did? They cut the price to $1 in a week.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So if you want to go, you can go for $1.
Well, that's what I was thinking. That's the only solution as a businessman, is to cut the price and get the volume, right?
Because it's cost them just as much to open up the stadium if they have 20,000, if they have 10,000. You'll find more people coming in there bringing their own food, which is reasonable for two bases, because once you eat the food there, you don't want to eat it there again. And you get a Coke there or something like that, it's $1, and it's 3/4 water and ice.
$1 for a Coke. Do you find it hard, or how do you feel about the prices today? Getting used to the prices, for example, $1 for a Coke.
Well, when you're at a ball game, they don't mind paying $1 for a Coke. Because you're at the ball game, you're thirsty, and now they charge you $1 in the store or McDonald's, you'd be very upset. But people don't mind that because they are accustomed to it at that particular time. You don't mind paying a big price for a dinner at a fancy restaurant. There's a particular restaurant in town, I won't mention the name, but it'll cost you about $30 for dinner, but they have three waiters going along. As soon as my wife flicks an ash on an ashtray, that ash is gone. And they have waiters with white gloves. I don't like it. I don't like people hovering over me.
Yeah.
She doesn't like it either, but once in a while, for a birthday or something, we'll go there. But when you go there, you know you're going to pay $60, $70 for dinner for two. You can go to another restaurant and get just as good a meal, $15. But when you go to that second restaurant, you're not accustomed to paying that much. So in the first restaurant, if your check is $60, you might tip the waiter $10, $12. The second restaurant, same kind of food, no better food, $15, you tip the waiter $3 or $4, because you wouldn't think of paying him $10. So when people are buying a certain item, they have no objection to paying the higher price. They just don't, if they want to object, they don't go to the place to begin with.
That's true. However, my point, and I didn't make it clear enough, was that we, or those of us who are past 65, find it hard to get used to the present day prices. And
well,
I wondered how, if it...
Well, but you have to get used to your present day income also, because take, for example, Social Security was first enacted. The minimum was, I think, something like $35 a month. I should have a choice of getting $35 a month Social Security and paying 20 cents for a quart of milk, or getting $300 and paying 60 cents for a quart of milk.
Yes.
Actually, the older people have gained relatively more in the last 10 years. It's a fallacy to say that the elderly population has suffered. They have gained more, much more. Because for Social Security was adjusted according to consumer price indexes, and two of the things that made the index move up rapidly were interest costs and housing costs, neither of which bothered most retired people because they didn't have a house on a mortgage and they weren't borrowing money.
What sort of changes have you seen in the study of economics and the place of economists in our society during your career?
First of all, it's become highly mathematical. You must be virtually a math major to get anywhere in economics and understand it. If you're not a math major, just give up. And I don't mean mathematics in the sense of arithmetic. I'm talking